Good evening, and welcome to the Solari Report. Today is Thursday, March 12, 2009. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, we're going to review the top stories in money and markets. Then we're going to address your questions and get a market update on precious metals with Franklin Sanders of The Money Changer. And afterwards, I'm going to talk about Stanley Kubrick's movie Eyes Wide Shut and what it means to the new proposed healthcare database by the government, which I've described in my article, The Data Beast. So first, money and markets. There's so much news, and there's so much to say that you're almost, Bill King has a great expression. He says you just couldn't make this stuff up. But it was quite a week. Essentially what we've got, if you step back and look at things with a very broad framework, we've had a pump and dump like the one we had in the 80s, but this one was much bigger, much more global, involved the stock market, and also involved the top financial institutions taking many more liabilities to engineer the pump. Now we're in the dump. And when you're in a dump like this, it's a little bit like musical chairs. A lot of people who thought they were insiders are finding the chairs pulled on them because they're not needed. I mean, think of, we have a whole wave of fraudsters who were needed during the pump, but they're not needed during the dump. And so what we're watching is tremendous game of musical chairs combined with just outbreaks of all sorts of squabbles about who's going to win and who's going to lose, who's going to be left with a chair and who's going to be thrown overboard. And so you're watching that play out as a subtext to all the financial news. So let's just run through some of the things that happened. We put up an article this week called Bailout More Money. We tried to collect up all the updates. Bloomberg had done an excellent list of all the different monies by the central bank and the Treasury up through November 2008 that could be called bailout. So it's loans, stimulus package, other things from the government, primarily to help the banks. In November, Bloomberg totaled the number at $8.5 trillion. Our roundup totals it, depending on how you want to count it, are estimated at about $12 to $14 trillion. So the pouring of money into the banks continues unchecked, and at a snappy pace. Part of this new bailout money includes money for AIG. We got a very astute question from somebody who pointed out or asked the question, are these derivative positions the derivative positions that are being used to rig the stock market and the precious metals markets and other markets? My guess is yes, because what we're watching is money poured into AIG and that money then going out and covering the positions at lots of different banks. There's an article in the Wall Street Journal about positions at Deutsche Bank and Goldman Sachs being protected. One of the instruments that AIG was a leader in were something called basically the swaps that guaranteed the credits of mortgage-backed securities and other instruments. And what that means is if there was significant collateral fraud or appraisal fraud in those pools, so there's 10 mortgages on one house or the appraisals are pumped up, that the person providing that swap is then left holding the bag in a variety of different instances. And my guess is that a lot of the money going into AIG is helping to basically fill the hole left by that fraud. One of AIG's largest investors announced this week that he is giving up on AIG as a shareholder and equity value. So that's a signal that it may take a lot more government money going into that black hole before that black hole is filled up. Another great question we got was Citibank's chairman triggered a supposed large rally in the stock market this week after announcing that Citibank had profits for the first 2 months. And one of our subscribers said, how in the world could Citibank report a profit given all the things it's doing and all the government bailouts? So Citibank desperately needs government bailouts, but suddenly it's booking a profit. Is that possible? And the answer is theoretically yes, it is possible. If Citibank has a huge problem on its balance sheet, if the government is propping up its balance sheet, it is technically possible in the first 2 months, particularly if the SEC is waiving rules that require it to mark to market, it is technically possible in some of its core businesses for Citibank to declare a profit. Let me give you an example. The last time this happened in the beginning of 1990s, when Citibank was bankrupt, what the Fed did was started loaning Citibank significant amounts of money, and Citibank would turn around and lend them back to the U.S. Treasury for a substantial increase. So, for example, if the government's lending at 2% and Citibank at that time was buying treasuries at about 6%, they could make a profit and they could leverage that for much more profits. And literally, they just built profits that funded the deficits created by the losses on the various bubble instruments. Citibank can do that again. I'll give you another example. We talk usually every week. The national CD rate is about 1.5% to 2%, depending on where you are. The average national credit card rate is above 13%. So if Citibank is borrowing from the government at a certain rate and turning around and lending it to all of us at 13%, that spread, if you will, the difference between the two, is profit that they can then book, which raises the question, why do we need Citibank? I mean, we don't need Citibank. If you think of the technology that made eBay, that technology can also be used to disintermediate banks so that citizens can fund the U.S. Treasury without Citibank in the middle. So what you're seeing is ways of making profit that are very expensive to the economy and very expensive to the consumer, but are financing this kind of central economy that we've all been talking about. One of the announcements was the budget deficit is now, for the first 5 months, up to $765 billion. Shadow Stats estimates that layoffs in February were not the 699,000 official number, but is projecting something much higher, almost 900,000. One of the most disturbing things that happened this week was Dean Baker, who is sits at a progressive think tank in Washington, gave testimony proposing that the solution for the losses that Americans have taken on 401ks and IRAs, one way to solve this problem would be to create retirement funds. He described it initially as an option, where instead of people having 401ks and IRAs where they control the investments, instead they just get a guaranteed yield from the government, in essence collapsing 401ks and IRAs in those cases into the equivalent of Social Security. Now, the important thing to understand about Social Security is those reserves don't exist. They've been looted, essentially. And this would be a way you could really continue the looting. So it's a dreadful idea. And it's a disturbing idea because it is giving credibility to the notion that the solution to 401k and IRA loss in value is to give government greater powers and greater intervention and greater control in people's retirement savings. So I just note that. One thing that you may want to consider if you have capital losses as a result of the corrections in the markets over the last year or two, you may want to talk to your accountant about whether you can use those losses to start to distribute money out of your 401ks and IRAs if you're concerned about government intervention. We saw Madoff make a plea bargain this week, announced today. It's important to understand about the events in the Madoff case is that we have now $68 billion worth of losses reported by his investors. Because of the way the indictment and conviction was negotiated, no information is going to come out about what happened or why. No documents are going to come out in court. This is a completely sealed, shut case, and that means incredible institutional secrecy. The notion that this guy did any of this on his own is just patently absurd, and whatever deal Madoff made, it's designed to protect a whole system behind him and to protect anyone from knowing where the money really went. In sort of the secrecy trend, we had another very profound development. Let's see if it gets picked up on it. I doubt it will make it into the mainstream press. Congress has dropped from the stimulus package their condition that contracts funded, government contracts funded with the stimulus package must be posted on the internet. Now, what this means is that the government has consistently resisted putting government contracting budgets and the contracts up on the web. So it is almost impossible, except for a very diligent researcher who's willing to spend years, submitting freedom of information requests. It's very difficult to understand which government contractors control and manage what scopes of work at the different agencies. So, for example, when $4 trillion went missing in the late 90s and early 2000s, we knew that government contractors were managing those payment and accounting systems. It was like pulling teeth to try and identify the names of the contractors or to get copies of the contracts. So this is a very important little, I call it a trim tab, for Congress to say, no, we're going to make this non-transparent. They're leaving a provision in that says that they're still going to post a summary of the contract, but not the contract itself. Very much not the same thing. Finally, to give you a sense of how arrogant the, sort of the shock and awe is, J.P. Morgan announced that they're outsourcing hundreds of millions of IT jobs to India. So here's a bank that's getting massive central bank and treasury subsidies. And in a month that we have, or last month we have, depending on whether you believe the government or shadow stats, we have 700,000 to 900,000 layoffs. And the jobs created from their operations, they're shipping abroad. So, certainly in the last bubble bust in 89-90, the banks would never have had the political clout to do this. The fact that J.P. Morgan thinks it can do this with impunity really suggests that times have changed. So great musical chairs. The stock market was up. It probably doesn't mean a lot. My guess is it's what's called a bear market rally, which is on the way down. You get a run up, and a lot of people get tricked to buy into it. Again, if you look at the PEs that we've seen in different recessions or depressions, they're significantly below where they are now. If you just multiply out the levels, we're talking about a Dow of 4,500 or even lower. So we had the head of the Singapore Sovereign Wealth Fund. You know, I've been saying the shakeout's about 50% over. We have the head of the Singapore Sovereign Wealth Fund saying it's about 30% over and telling everybody to buy gold. So we're on our way through, and we have a long way to go before we see how all this shakes out and where the market really, where equity levels find their bottom. So that's my word for this week, musical chairs. The musical chairs is going to continue all year. And so look for a lot of fighting and squabbling as many insiders discover that they're no longer insiders. So with that, we're gonna address the rest of your questions with Franklin. Franklin, are you with us?
I'm right here.
Okay. Well, I'm over at Franklin's fabulous compound here in Mid Tennessee. We've just had a wonderful dinner. Franklin, we've had a correction in the precious metals market. Just bring us up to date on what's happened since we visited with you last.
Well, just about a month ago, we had a high, another run up to $1,000. Which is now the all-time high of the market. Then we got pretty predictably a reaction back from that, and the reaction carried down to about 890. And the question was, the question has been, is that the end of it? And I didn't really think so until today. And gold has shown a tremendous amount of strength. Silver too. Of course, you know, they could still go down perhaps a little farther. But the important thing to remember here is to keep your eyes on the horizon. The long-term trend is up, very much up, and probably by the end of the year, we're going to see gold over $1,600. So you just have to, you can't be shaken by these day-to-day moves. One of the things that has developed in about the last 2 weeks is that we've seen a return of delayed deliveries in both gold and silver, especially in the gold. I had an astonishing thing happen today. One of the largest wholesalers that I deal with announced that he is not going to deal in American Eagle gold coins until further notice. And the reason is, very simply, he just can't get them. They're just not, there's not an available, reliable supply of them. People who have them won't turn loose of them. And so the premium keeps creeping up on those and other coins. And now the deliveries are out about 2 weeks instead of being immediate. So whenever you see that cramping up of supply, you know that something's going on. And you could see that in the market too. The gold market gets knocked down, and then it just comes right back.
It's funny. I call it the heartbeat. It's not like last year it get knocked down and sort of wallow in depression. Now it gets knocked down and suddenly boom, 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 boom. You know, and I look at it. It's so strong, and that's different than last year.
Well, and one of the things that's been interesting to me is that silver has really been leading the way almost most of this year, even back into December. And, of course, silver, you know, is more volatile on the downside, too. That means it drops faster. But it's like silver is straining against the leash and saying, come on, let's go. Come on, get going. And, it's, you know, whenever I see that, I know that you've got some really, really strong buyers underneath the market.
One of the questions we got that I thought was good is it said, when would you sell gold and silver?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, when I looked at it, I said, you know, I wouldn't sell gold and silver until I had an alternative payment mechanism, and I don't know what that would be.
Right. Well, you know, when will that come? If this were just a technical question, if you were asking me technically what would mark the top in the market, then I would say, well, whenever 16 ounces of silver would buy 1 ounce of gold, then it's time to get out. But the question is, what are you going to get out into? And
right.
If there's no payment mechanism that is as safe as gold and silver are, then you don't have anything to get out into.
Well, you know, this week we saw reports of a rift between the European Union and the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
because the U.S. is doing massive stimulus, whether it's the stimulus package or the rest of the bailout. So we're up to 12 to 14 trillion plus headed for a $1 trillion deficit. And the Europeans are not borrowing and spending at the same rate.
Well, right. I read an interesting article this week about the Germans. You know, the Germans have suffered first a hyperinflation that resulted in the complete collapse of the economy and of all values. In other words, they lost all their savings in 1923. And 1923, of course, contributed to the rise of Hitler. The hyperinflation really set the stage for Hitler. And then after the war, the mark collapsed again, and everybody was, you know, back to square one again. So the Germans are extremely sensitive about inflation.
Right.
You know, it's in the memory of living Germans, the entire economy or everybody in the economy has lost everything because the currency unit evaporated. So they're very much opposed to that, and they're you know, that creates a lot of internal stress between the inside the euro, because you've got France, you've got, well, to France to a lesser extent, but you've got Italy, Spain, and Greece who want to inflate to get their economies going, and they have, you know, they don't have that sense of restraint
right.
that Germany does. So there's a tremendous internal tension there that's working against the euro long term. You know, there was something else that happened yesterday, too. The Swiss announced that they had been selling francs against the euro and that they were going to buy federal government bonds, that is their federal government bonds, which is a way to get money into circulation. So obviously they're taking, the Swiss Central Bank is taking its own stimulus position, but more than that, they're trying to depreciate their currency to promote their exports. And if you'll remember, during the Great Depression, that was exactly what occurred. There was a wave of competitive devaluations around the globe, and so it looks like the Swiss have fired the first salvo in that war again.
Right. Well, they did that right after they got hit with the bank secrecy, mm-hmm. because there's clearly a war going on. I'm going to be in Switzerland in the last week of this month, and I'm very curious to see, you know, sort of what people are saying on the ground. Mm-hmm. But the attack on Swiss bank secrecy, my interpretation is they're fighting over those deposits. The U.S. wants those deposits to come here.
Right.
So and they want them to stop going to Switzerland. And so it's interesting that the Swiss then turn around and raise capital this way, mm-hmm. Or put money in circulation this way, because I think it's part of this greater war over who's going to get the deposits.
Right. Well, I think one of the things that people, this is typical the way the U.S. government works, is that anybody that opposes them, they class as a criminal, and they denounce as criminals. And so the Swiss and the whole idea of banking secrecy is denounced as criminals.
Right.
Well, somebody's got a short memory here, because I've actually talked to people who survived because of Swiss banking secrecy.
Right.
People who got out of Germany who had been able to put a little bit of money in Switzerland out of the country, and that enabled them to survive when they escaped Germany.
Right. I have too. They either had money or family abroad, or they had gold coins.
Right.
And that's how they got out. Let me run through some of the questions. We have one. I want to buy 100,000 of silver in part so I can play the gold-silver ratio, but the thought of storing, shipping approximately 450 pounds of silver leaves me cold. What are my alternatives?
Well, first of all, I think you have to look at this big grizzly bear of shipping silver. $100,000 would be about 9 bags of silver coin. That's at roughly $11,000 a bag. A bag is about a gallon and a half, so we're talking about 13.5 gallons of the equivalent of 13.5 gallons of mass. Well, just think about what 13.5 gallons of milk looks like, and that's how much volume you have to deal with.
Right.
And the weight is not that big a deal. A bag weighs about 55 pounds. We ship them all the time. Tonight over supper, we asked Susan, you know, how long does it take to pack one up? She said 5 minutes. So assuming you don't know what you're doing, say it'd take a half an hour, you know.
Right.
But this is a job for one day, and it costs maybe $350 to ship it by registered insured mail. So it's not really that much of a problem, and we don't do it that often. We've made, I think, 4 trades since 2002.
Right.
So it's
not something you're doing every month.
No. Catherine, we had one lady that, this is not, I'm not exaggerating this, she had 100 bags. We had to send a Brinks truck to her house. But we did it, and she had about a 48% increase on the number of ounces that she had. So is that worth it? Well, to me, it's worth it.
Yeah.
So I think that the trouble of it is grossly over-exaggerated. It's not that bad when you
really. Well, if they don't want to take physical control, you can also use a depository.
You can. There's a depository in New Orleans, for example, that will actually do the shipping for you.
Right.
At a fairly reasonable rate. But all those things involve more money. You know, you have
right.
to pay somebody to do that. Or you can use, you know, gold money if you don't want to take actual
right.
delivery yourself.
Right. And it's just, to me, it's just part of the beat.
Right. And, you know, you have to expect, people have to understand that the world of physical money, physical gold and silver, is not the world of electrons.
Right.
When you go, you know, Charles Schwab can charge you, you know, 1.5% or 2% or whatever he charges, because there's nothing to it. He's not
right.
doing anything. He's moving electrons from one part of the computer to the other part.
Right.
Whereas when you've got physical metal, somebody actually has to pack it, somebody has to store it, somebody has to safeguard it, somebody has to insure it. And so there's actual physical transaction. There's a physical transaction taking
place. Right, but there's a physical value. In this environment, you're doing it because you want that physicality. I mean, if you look at the brokerage system and you really dig in and look at things like naked short selling, the real question is if the music should stop completely and the brokerage system says there are 1,000 shares, you know, it's promised 1,000 shares to people, but there are only 100.
What happens then?
And we've seen the same thing with unallocated pools at the banks. You know, 1,000 customers think they have 1,000 ounces of gold, and it turns out the bank only has 100 ounces. So,
right. That's exactly the reason why I stay away from those, and I stay away from the EFTs
right.
as well. Yeah.
Right. So it depends on why you're buying. Are you buying because you think gold is in a bull market and it's going to rise? Are you buying because you want a safe store of value in the worst case?
And exactly, the ultimate cash.
Right. So if you want it for the worst case, then you have to grapple with the physicality.
Right. And it's not, again, it's the difficulty of doing that is vastly overrated. You know, $100,000 worth of gold, for instance, is the size of 3 packages of cigarettes.
Well, but let me play the devil's advocate, because the first time I found out that you were going to mail me my precious metals, or that I had to grapple with where I was going to put, I found it shocking. It's a little bit like when I moved to the country and, you know, watched an animal get slaughtered before I ate it, you know. So there's a, you know, you're moving from a world where everything is abstract to where everything is real. And it's for people who haven't done it, it's a big switch. And
well, it's a big switch, but it's also a big high. You know,
right.
I've watched it over and over. People who touch a gold coin for the first time, they get this kind of light on their
uh-huh.
face, and they say, oh, I understand now.
It's real. It's real. We had a great question from, just a wonderful subscriber, who asked about small transactions.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you have the monthly acquisition plan. Before I ask the question, maybe you could explain the monthly acquisition plan.
Right. Well, that's for specifically people who don't have a lot to invest. The minimum investment is $100 a month. And it gives you the opportunity to invest every month, but you're not obligated to invest every month. So, in other words, as long as your payment reaches us by the 15th of the month, and when we pool all the orders on the 15th, then we include you in that number. And the advantage of it is that you don't pay any small order charge. You pay the same price as if you were buying $5,000 worth of gold or silver. And so that really cuts down the amount of transaction costs that you have. One of the problems is if you go to a coin shop, say, a local coin shop, and there's nothing wrong with local coin shops, it's just that if you're going to buy a roll of American Eagles, they're not going to sell them to you for $17.20 a piece. They're going to sell them to you for, you know, $19, $20, $21 a piece, because they have to have a bigger markup, you know. They have,
for a small transaction,
right.
The percentage is greater.
Right, exactly. And so, you know, you have to pay a larger transaction. And in that question in particular, he was talking about paying a, you know, a 40% spread. That's way too much.
Right.
And that's one of the reasons why on the MAP program, what we try to do is to find the form of silver or gold that has the lowest premium over its gold, over its content. And, you know, another problem is shipping. In the last 3 years, the post office has raised rates, I don't know, 3 times, but they've gone, a package that used to cost us about $4 now costs us from $6 to $8. So shipping is a problem. But again, do you want possession of it? Do you want to have it in your hands?
You know, next week I'm going to, we're doing the nuts and bolts of organizing a Solari circle.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I'm going to suggest during that is combining something like a hand or a partnership with the map. And here's how it would work. Now, you have to have people you really trust.
Right.
But you get a group of people you're close to and you trust, so 10 people. And you come together once a month, and each month everybody puts $100 in the pot.
Mm-hmm.
So now you've got $1,000.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now you buy $1,000 of gold and silver, or silver, and in that month one person takes it all.
Mm-hmm.
And then each month one person takes it all.
Mm-hmm.
And that way you can aggregate your purchases, and you get a much better, in terms of percentage premiums, you pay a lot less for your transaction costs and your shipping.
Precisely.
Right.
Right.
So there are ways to do it, but you've got to think it out.
Right. But the problem is that what I found is for most people, if they're dealing with a local dealer, unless they've got somebody who's really sharp and really, you know, cuts his corners close, they're going to end up paying almost too high premium, too high spread to work with. But still, even at that, even if you have nothing else to do, you know, even if that's the only thing you have to do, I think you're better off doing that than doing nothing, because the alternative is what? What can you do with $100?
Right. Now, if you leave it in the dollar, here's the question. If you leave it in the dollar, last year you were okay because the dollar was up 5%, gold was up 4%. The big question for all of us, Franklin, and it's one I fret about every day, is we know inflation is coming. And the question is when.
Well, yeah, the dollar index is the measure of the dollar that I follow most closely. That's dropped from 120 in 2001 to about 70 early last year.
Right.
So, you know, if you leave your money in the dollar, you know what's going to happen.
Right. Well, it's interesting. I told you this Thursday night when I settled the litigation. I put a portion of the money that I was reserving for taxes in coins.
Mm-hmm.
And then it took me, I liquidated them in 2007, 2008. So I bought them in 2006, liquidated in 2007, 2008. And I just calculated, I was working on my taxes, and I calculated we got, almost a 60% increase, even after all transaction costs.
Right.
And, you know, so...
Well, you know, there's an old saying about transaction costs that if the investment won't pay for its transaction costs, you shouldn't do it anyway.
Right.
So, and we assume that it'll pay for those transaction costs. This is, you know, I saw some folks in a church that I know who had a building fund, and they started about 2001 in that building fund and they took all their money and put it in gold, and they wound up after about 5 years with about twice as much purchasing power as they began with.
Right. We did that in my Solaria circle. We changed our bylaws so we could leave our cash in gold.
Yeah.
And we've done very well on that.
Yeah.
One of the questions we got was, why are gold and the U.S. dollar chart actions diverging this week? And that's for you, because I don't know.
Well, I'm not sure what they mean by diverging. The dollar has been... down this week. Gold was down some days too, and then today, for instance, they moved strongly opposite to each other. The thing to remember about that is that, you know, we get in our minds this idea that gold and the dollar move opposite to each other.
Right.
And so we expect them to do that every day. Well, the truth is they move opposite to each other over the long term, over a year, over a month. They'll move opposite to each other. But day by day, there may be forces in the market that cause them both to go up at the same time.
Right.
Or both to go down at the same time. And those forces might continue for several weeks. Right now, for instance, it seems that the stock market and the dollar are negatively correlated. That is, every time the dollar rises, the stock market falls, and vice versa. If you'll notice, the days out of the last 4 days when the stock market has had some very strong rises, the dollar has been down considerably.
Right.
So I think you just have to, it's a matter of perspective. They don't go, gold and the dollar don't move in lockstep day after day, day by day, but they do over time, they're negatively correlated.
You know, one of the things I wanted to ask you was the people, you have a steady and strong business. What are you seeing in terms of the kinds of people now who are investing in gold and silver? Are you seeing a big change?
We've seen a big change in the last year or year and a half. The size of our transactions has gone up considerably. In other words, it's what I call serious money. It's not
a small portion of your holdings.
No, it's
starting to be a major asset class.
Right. These are people who are making serious, very serious commitments to gold,
right,
and to silver. And then, you know, of course, we've done a lot of IRA shifting from stocks to silver and gold too. But the difference is there's no question that probably 40 to 50% of our transactions are what I would call larger transactions now.
Right. We got another question. It's real funny. Every time Chris Powell hears this question, he has a temper tantrum.
Uh-huh.
It said, today on Bloomberg, the government said the Obama administration soon will also push Congress for legislation that allows the IMF to mobilize its stockpile of gold. Secretary of Treasury said today Congress would need to approve the IMF funding expansion, although it wouldn't count against the budget deficit, he said. The question is, what on earth does mobilize mean? I'm long in gold and find this statement unnerving.
So do I get to throw the temper tantrum?
Yeah, you can throw the temper tantrum now.
Well, you know, if you have been around in gold for 10 years or so, or let's say 12 years, 14, this is an old duck. This is an old red herring, old canard that they have pulled so many times that it has gray hair. Every time that gold threatens to go up, the IMF or the U.S. or somebody says we ought to sell all that IMF gold. And people who are green to the gold market and just don't have the experience, you know, just haven't been there, they're scared to death. Yeah, they're scared to death, and they don't understand that this is nothing but a propaganda action. That's all it is. They've been talking about selling that IMF gold since 1992 and never have sold an ounce of it and won't sell an ounce of it because, in the first place, they have to have a unanimous vote in order to sell it.
Yeah, and Congress has to vote.
Right, and that's not going to happen. It's just not going to happen.
Well, the other thing is if they do sell, it's going to be a great buying opportunity. And it's funny, if you look at the people who liked it, there were reports this week that central banks had bought in January, and interestingly enough, the largest central bank purchasing was not Russia. I had expected it to be Russia. It was Ecuador.
Hmm.
Now, Ecuador was forced on the dollar not that long ago.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that the central bank is buying really significant positions in gold, I find to be very interesting.
Somebody's sniffing the wind.
Right. And so, you know, you've got Russia buying, you've got Singapore buying, you've got a variety of different central banks and sovereign wealth. So if the IMF sold, or even leased, that's the kind of buying opportunity that those players need to take a significant position.
Right, those are the size players that step up for that kind of buy.
Right. So to me, it would be a great buying opportunity. Bring it on.
Right. Let me just give you one other, another similar canard that comes out with silver. These analysts who don't know anything about silver go and analyze silver, and they come to the conclusion, lo and behold, digital photography is going to replace silver in photography. We've been hearing that one since 1980, and the fact is it is slowly happening. It will happen. It will never be 100% because of the quality of silver in photography. But it's not going to happen fast enough to make any difference for us in the next, say, 5 or 10 years. But you see that same, whenever they want to slam silver, they come out with a story about, you know, digital replacing silver in photography.
And if they slam gold, the environment.
Oh, yes. Oh, by the way, speaking of slamming gold.
Newsweek.
There was an article in Newsweek this week about gold and the net was you're a little bit of a suspect human being if you invest in gold, and you might be just downright degenerate.
Now, but I haven't seen Newsweek. I saw the National Geographic, but I haven't seen that. What does the Newsweek say?
Well, basically, you know, that gold is for paranoids or people who live in iron behind the Iron Curtain, and you know, it you're giving up hope on humanity and the future if you buy gold. I mean, it's just it's really heavy-handed. They somehow roped in this an economist who writes for Kitco, which is a big gold site, and made him sound as if, you know, he didn't even think you ought to buy gold. I'm sure by selective quotations, but it's just it's basically a pan, like the National Geographic article back in December, I think it was, where, you know, gold mining is responsible single-handedly for ruining the environment,
you know,
around the world.
It reminds me, because when you look at the hit jobs that media does on something, you know, when the boys order up a hit job, the hit jobs 10 years ago were pretty sophisticated, but they're getting pretty thin. And I want to point this out because it does relate to gold. Did you see, I put this up on the blog, I put up the financial permaculture video, which is a video that one of the participants made at the Financial Permaculture Conference in Hohenwald, Tennessee, and it's basically 30 minutes of a small southern Christian community coming together to look at economic development, including doing ethanol or biodiesel.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And then 2 weeks ago, Glenn Beck on Fox, there's a Fox News program called War Room, basically did a hit job on southern communities who do biodiesel and try and be more self-sufficient. I know, I guess they use the word ethanol.
Mm-hmm.
And you look at these two, I put it up, and they called it the Bubba effect.
Right.
And you put up these two videos, and they're basically talking about the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it is amazing to see the different portrayal of essentially the same phenomena. One
right.
from fear and one, you know, sort of very lovely.
Right. Well, and you know, it's hard not to, I try not to be conspiratorial in my thinking, but it's hard not to be when you see something like what appeared on Glenn Beck's show. I mean, what could be more praiseworthy than a local community trying to solve its fuel needs in a way that benefits the local economy and delivers us from dependence on foreign oil?
Well, that was the problem. They couldn't think of anything bad to say about it,
uh-huh.
So they kind of wandered around and threw out a lot of fear words and ran around in circles.
Right.
And you see the same thing with gold because, you know, what I've always said is that fiat currency has caused far more environmental damage than the worst mining company, which is terrible, the worst mining company ever dreamed of.
Right.
And yet that's a concept for most people who are not familiar with financial systems. That's a big shock when they hear that. And because it's interesting, if you look at a lot of the different environmental not-for-profits,
mm-hmm.
and you look at their endowments or socially responsible investors, they all have massive positions over the last 10 years in J.P. Morgan Chase, Citibank, all the big financials.
Well, yeah, let me take that a step deeper, because I used to write about – I spent about 4 years writing about the environmental movement. Go, just order their yearly reports, their annual reports, and flip over to the back and look where they get their money. And you'll find out that the environmental movement, at least as far as those big organizations are concerned, has nothing to do with the grassroots, and it has everything to do with the very corporations that they supposedly attack.
Right.
I mean, you know, waste management. Weyerhaeuser, those are the biggest contributors to environmental groups.
Right.
And you just scratch your head at first saying, well, wait a minute, what's going on here? And then you realize it's the principle of controlling the opposition. They create their own opposition because they can be controlled that way.
Right. And my fear, if you look at the stimulus package, is you're basically, you know, the greatest war over what happens, the future of the United States, will be between federal, state, and local government in the cash flows that go back and forth between state and local government and the feds.
Mm-hmm.
And because when you think about it, it's the local guys who really are on the line communicating with the real taxpayers. So if that $1 trillion is going to flow up to Washington, you know, the folks down home have to be happy and willing to write the check and send it.
Right.
And when you look at the stimulus package and all these deficits, what you're seeing is, you know, just massive amounts of fees for our friends going down to buy state and local government to go along with all these different changes in the rules.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what, if you see the states who are filing these 10th Amendment, 10th Amendment legislation saying, you know, asserting states' rights, there's a chicken and egg problem because they're filing legislation asserting states' rights, but then they're running to Washington begging for more stimulus money. So, you know, we're getting, you know, the question is how much of our own money will it take to buy us out of or buy us into all these rules? So what do we think is ahead for the precious metals market over the next month? What should we
expect? There are two different tracks that can unfold. The first track is that I'm wrong, that we haven't seen a bottom, and we could get anywhere from 2 to 4 weeks of lower prices. And the bottom boundary of that range would be, say, $850, maybe on a spike, $800, but something like that. That's the pessimistic outlook. And then we would get a recovery and another high later in the spring, probably by now in May. On the other hand, we may have already seen the bottom. This is what I think is the most likely outcome. We've already seen the bottom. We saw it this week. And there won't be any more downside lower than what we've seen. Gold now is going to make another try for to pierce $1,000. If it makes it through on this attempt, then it will run for somewhere between $1,250 and $1,600. Catherine, things are so volatile that it's difficult to look at markets and estimate what they'll do under the normal rules.
What you've got is you've got an absolutely huge bond market. And you have, I put up charts this week of the cash
mm-hmm.
that's kind of sidelined.
Mm-hmm.
So you literally have more cash now sidelined in money markets and treasuries than you have in total stock market cap.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you've got just huge amounts of money in the bond market. The minute that money thinks that inflation is really beginning, and just, 5 to 10% of that money tries to find another place to go, that's when I think you get that run for $1,250 or $1,600. And I think that the important thing I think we need to stress is if acquiring gold and silver is something you want to do it while it's available.
Right. Well, it's the old principle of staying out of fights and bars.
We hadn't heard that one. You need to tell us that one.
How do you stay out of a fight in a bar?
You don't go in a bar.
You don't go in a bar. That's right. That's very simple, you know. In other words, you're not there when the crisis happens.
Right.
And in the same way, if you want to be in gold and silver and you don't want to be caught up in whatever kind of crisis unfolds, you have to get into it now. You have to get into it before the fight starts, before the panic starts. And that's, you know, I know I do a lot of talking about, and maybe I shouldn't. Maybe I ought to just shut up and not talk about what I think the market's going to do, this, that, and just say, look, it's going up. It's going to go a lot higher. Buy some. And
right.
Just leave it at that.
Right. And it's really not going to go up. The fiat paper's going to go down.
That's exactly right.
So gold's not going to go up. It's,
yeah.
One quick question I know I've asked you a million times, if I've asked you once. We got a question on numismatics, and I think it's good to keep stressing this. Let me just read it. I purchased numismatic St. Gaudens gold coins several years ago. Would you recommend I sell these coins to instead purchase gold or silver coins or bullion? At that time, I was told that confiscation was possible. It seemed as if all the gold bugs were worried about a repeat of 33. If I made an unwise investment in the St. Gaudens coin, what would you recommend as an alternative? So should they swap now, and if yes, what should they go into?
Well, the answer is yes, you should swap now, and especially right now, because the premiums on those coins, that is the distance between their cost and the cost of bullion, has been narrowing. They have been losing value against bullion for the last 10 years, and I've got the data on that, so I know that that's a true statement. However, last fall, when we had the steep drops in gold, those coins did not go down as much. In other words, they regained a lot of premium. They still have a high premium, And, of course, that's going to disappear as the price of gold rises. So this, at this point, the distance between the price of those coins and the price of bullion is probably, if not at its greatest, it's at the greatest point or near the greatest point that it's been in the last 10 years. So this is the time to swap those coins for bullion-type coins right now.
And what kind of bullion coin should they?
Well, if they're going into gold, you know, just the lowest premium coins we can find, Mexican 50 pesos, Austrian 100 coronas, whatever we can find cheap at the time. Unfortunately, there's not anything very, very inexpensive in silver. 100-ounce bars is about the only thing that we can get into that really, you know, they've got about a 12% premium. So that I would say that, or maybe 1-ounce rounds. But
so it's that thing which has the smallest premium to melt value, which is in essence the amount of gold or silver in the coin or the bar times spot price.
Right, that's exactly right.
Okay, I just wanted to mention for our listeners, Franklin last month did we went through the 10 most commonly asked questions. Mm-hmm. That he gets from people beginning to invest in gold and silver coin. And I really recommend that you, it's in the archives if you haven't heard it, and I really recommend you go back because it covers, Franklin, all, you know, you did a great job of covering all the questions that we always get, and it's just a great place to start.
Well, I've had a lot of practice.
Well, hopefully making that tape will cause you to have less practice. Okay, well, Franklin, thank you so much. We look forward to doing this again next month. It's always a pleasure.
Oh, it's my
and
pleasure.
And you're gonna join us now for Let's Go to the Movies. We're going to talk about the both the movie Eyes Wide Shut, which I had invited all of the subscribers to watch along with me, and I saw it again this week for about the, seen it now about four times. And I want to talk about it in the context of my latest article, The Data Beast, which I wrote basically to give my thoughts and intuitions on the administration's proposed national health database. And I asked Franklin to stay on. He's read the Data Beast article and is sort of familiar with some of the issues. So I asked him to stay on for the discussion. First, let me just say a few words about Eyes Wide Shut, because it's a difficult movie to watch. Tom Cruise plays a doctor who lives in New York. Nicole Kidman, who was then his wife, plays his wife in the movie. The movie was the last movie made by Stanley Kubrick, who died shortly after the movie came out. In the movie, the doctor, played by Tom Cruise, crashes a party given by a secret society. And there's a lot I could say about this movie, but I really just want to focus you on one point. And that point is as follows. When you talk about, you know, for example, if you ask one of your relatives where they were when Kennedy was killed, you'll hear story after story of people saying, they killed the president. Or, you know, I've always told you the story about the largest pension fund in the country, the president telling me they are moving all the money out starting in the fall. And, of course, the question always is, who is they? And Eyes Wide Shut, the scenes of the secret society party give a incredible sort of feeling, emotional picture of who they is. They is a group of people, and there are two characteristics I really want to underscore. They believe in slavery, and they have the power to kill with impunity. When I was Assistant Secretary of Housing, I literally saw the Secretary of HUD have a temper tantrum and scream at a group of regional administrators and senior political appointees, I don't have to obey the law. I report to a higher authority. What he communicated with was that he essentially worked for a group of people who had complete totalitarian power, and the idea that we had to obey law or had to worry about what the courts thought was a joke. I mean, it was that bold and that arrogant. And watching Eyes Wide Shut, you get a sense for who they are and literally the power that they have. Now, why do I want to focus you on sort of getting a sense or a feel for what a powerful secret society is like? The reason I want to is whenever anybody says to me, we should pass a law and give the government power to do such and such, what I hear is we want to give this group of people that you see in the movie Eyes Wide Shut, we want to give this secret society who believes in slavery and has, you know, just the ability to kill with impunity, we want to give them the power to do whatever the proposal is. Now, when you say to me, I want to create laws that require every doctor in this country to keep records in digital form that are accessible on a timely basis to the federal government so that the federal government can micromanage what your treatments are, if they decide they're economic, shut them off, access that data, manipulate that data, aggregate that data with other things. For example, let's say somebody in the secret society needs a kidney transplant, and your child fits the perfect profile. Now, how long do you think it is until your child has an accident? I mean, these scenarios are not at all implausible, particularly when you see the idea of that database aggregated with other data and other purposes. And if you read my article, The Data Beast, I go into those kinds of questions. How did I get into this? Let me just give you a little background. My litigation with the federal government was triggered by a number of things, but one of them was the fact that we were building databases that made the sources and uses of government funding to the federal government completely accessible to citizens by place, so that you could dial up and see in your county or your neighborhood how much money was going to and from the federal government, both appropriations and credit, including mortgage credit. Now, that data would have made it possible to do significant economic local development and make government programs much more efficient. It would have also made it very, very difficult to do a lot of the mortgage fraud associated with the mortgage bubble. The process that occurred to me made it clear that we were paying defense contractors huge amounts of money. The largest defense contractor, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, got $150 million a year to manage all the information systems and databases. So we were paying defense contractors huge amounts of money to collect and manage this data, but the data that was required by law to be accessible to Americans, to citizens, was not, could not, and any effort to make it accessible was met with what I can only describe as unbelievably fierce and violent opposition. And so it taught me a little lesson about what it means when the U.S. government spends huge amounts of money to pay defense contractors to collect the most intimate data about us in ways that are, I can assure you, are not private. The notion that this would be private is absurd. If you look at the Data Beast article, I describe the role of databases and these kinds of databases in the Holocaust. The German databases for the Holocaust were built by IBM and were critical to building a slave labor force. And I also talk a little bit about doctor data and the dangers of it. And finally, I posted a video in the article of Aaron Rousseau, who was someone who Franklin knew and I knew, a wonderful movie producer, produced Trading Places that we've talked about on the Soleri Report, where he describes the plans confessed to him by a member of the Rockefeller family to basically chip human beings and use the chips to run a digital currency, a global digital currency. Sound far-fetched? You need to watch the video. It's the ultimate in fiat currencies. This database would make it possible. This database would be a critical component of what you need to do a global digital currency of that kind. So I would encourage you to watch Eyes Shut to get a feel for this. Now, the question, of course, is always, what can we do? And there are many different things that you can do. One of them is what I've done, and I know Franklin has done, which is we access a tremendous amount of healthcare services outside of the traditional healthcare systems. The other thing you can do is more and more people are now going abroad for healthcare. And one possibility, if you have the resources to do it, is to start to establish healthcare providers and healthcare records that you control, or healthcare providers outside the country in safer areas that don't report to this database. So there are many things you can do. It's always easier to do them. It takes, you know, years to make these kinds of changes. I started to make them in the late 90s when I realized what they were doing with medical records. That's when I sort of dropped out of the system. So there are many things you can do, but you need to understand now that this is happening and it's real. So, Franklin, I just wanted to invite you to make any comments you wanted.
Well, you know, I was just, as you're talking about medical things, you know, Susan had to have heart surgery. She had a mitral valve prolapse that gave way last August, and she had to have heart surgery. And we don't go to doctors. I mean, we don't have, literally do not have family physician, because we use all sorts of alternatives, and we take supplements, and we do things for ourselves. And one of the things that I noticed, now, her surgeon was great. The hospital was fabulous. The ICU care was the most diligent imaginable, competent people. But I always had the feeling that we were playing a game called Fix One, Break Two. And, you know, because of the way that these people are trained and the way their minds are work, they keep digging deeper and deeper into things, and they sort of make problems where there may not be a problem. And there has to be some sort of balance there. And I think that mainstream medicine has gone over the cliff in the pharmaceutical direction, and that's driven by profits. It's driven by, you know, a lot of things that aren't very complementary to human nature. But they want to put you on drugs. You know, I'm 62. I go in for a checkup to some place I haven't ever been before, and the first thing they ask me is, what medications are you on? And I say, I'm not on any medication.
But that's one of the reasons I finally stopped going. I just got tired of having that fight.
There's the Social Security number fight, right? Then why do you need my Social Security number to give me a shot?
One of the things, I just saw the president on television. I was in the gym. I don't have a TV, but I was in the gym on the treadmill. And the president was giving a conference on the extraordinary explosion in Medicare and healthcare expenses.
Mm-hmm.
And he sounded so sensible and intelligent. I mean, it just sounded great until you step back and realize, wait a minute, the driver of large costs in the healthcare system is, number one, the suppression of healthcare technology and knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, the promotion of lousy food and waters. And, you know, sort of other poisoning in the environment, some of which is very intentional. Three, the drug companies and the pricings and sort of things out of control, you know, and on and on and on.
And what is the common factor, the driving force, the motor behind all that?
Central control.
Right, exactly. It's
central control.
It's government.
Well, it's it's the eyes. If you describe the Eyes Wide Shut secret society as government, yes, it's government.
Right.
So, you know, so it sounds great, and then they say, well, the solution is we need this database, and that will bring the cost down. And, of course, that's not true. That's not, you know, you need the database for more central control.
Right, exactly.
Okay, well, Franklin, thank you again very much. Ladies and gentlemen, we have next week, we have on March 19th, we have Nuts and Bolts of Organizing a Ciliary Circle. And then in April, we've got our first week is going to be the roundup. We did a year-end wrap-up, and I like to do a wrap-up at the end of each quarter. So remember, you're in our prayers. We look forward to being with you next week and then 2 weeks after. Until then, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in one, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.